What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded during TBRCon 2024, the latest edition of FanFiatic's all-virtual annual science fiction, fantasy, and horror convention, which streamed live between January 21st and January 28th, 2024. FanFiatic and TBRCon had the pleasure of hosting 25 amazing author panels, and we're so happy to be able to provide the audio for you for free here on the podcast feed. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy this fantastic TBRCon 2024 author panel.
Everyone out there, welcome to TBRCon 2024 and our panel on the psychology of villains in fiction. So I'm very excited. I'm MJ Kuhn. I'm author of The Tales of Tamora duology, Among Thieves and Thick as Thieves, and co-host of SFF Addicts with the lovely Adrian M. Gibson. And I'm going to kick things off by introducing our wonderful panelists, or actually more accurately, asking them to introduce themselves. So we're going to start with Louise. You know, so for any viewers who might be unfamiliar, just tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Hi, my name is Louise Holland. I'm an indie fantasy author from Adelaide, South Australia. So it's the middle of the day for me. A little bit of a weird vibe. I'm the only one with daylight coming in. Oh no, maybe Grub as well. And I write fantasy fiction based on real life D&D campaigns. So my debut novel, Spark of the Divine, dropped in November last year. And it's technically a true story, which is kind of cool. Classic epic high fantasy with a lot of evil villains in it, which is why I'm here.
Love it. Love it. All right, Sam.
Hey, everyone. Sam Paisley. I am the author of the Elements of Time series, which hopefully anyone has heard of, but it's okay if you haven't. It's brand new. My debut series, book one, is out. I'll try and show it if I can. Okay, I'll just do this instead. That's the title. is a contemporary fantasy. It's actually set in 2009 because that's the time of my life that I like the best. And it's elemental magic. It's destiny. It's personal responsibility. It's the first of a trilogy. So if you like a fun action adventure that centers around two best friends being thrown into just a cosmic mess and figuring out what side they're on and what their abilities are, then please check it out.
Damn, that sounds fun.
No, right? Also, 2009, the era of AIM, that was the vibe. I'm with you. All right, Richard?
Hi, I'm Richard Swan. I'm the author of the Empire of the Wolf trilogy, which is with Orbit Books, and a bunch of other stuff as well. Currently here in, also in Australia, Louise, although the accent's but I'm up in Queensland on holiday at the moment in a airless, featureless white room. And anybody could come at any time. That's kind of me, really. I don't have anything else on the stocks at the moment. I don't even have a copy of my book to show anybody. You just have to kind of picture it in your heads.
I like it. We'll use our imaginations.
Here are the lines.
This thing that looks like a shot glass of urine, but I can assure you is...
you are in Queensland, so that wouldn't be...
Well, you know, it's a snifter of urine, much classier glass.
Yes, quite, yeah.
I don't know if I want a snifter of that. All right, Gura?
Hi, everyone. Namaste. I'm Gaurav Mohanty from India. I'm the author of Sons of Darkness. And by profession, I'm a lawyer. I think that makes me qualified to speak about villains like forever. Sons of Darkness is a reimagination of an Indian mythological poem called the Mahabharata, as in fact written from the perspective of traditionally perceived villains. So, yeah, that's that. I do have a copy of the book. Ta-da!
There it is. Sons of Darkness. So,
yeah. And it's freshly released, this one?
Yeah, it just got released like in US on January 9th, and it was released last year in the rest of the world. So, by the way, I love the way my room's color pop is contrasting with Richard's background. It's amazing. Mm. I love how they're like,
yes, it's a mirror image of our personalities. We're very cool.
Very nice side by side. All right, and Andy.
Yeah, so I'm Andy Peliquin. I write dark epic fantasy. Darkblade is set from the traditional villain's perspective, half demon assassin with the cursed dagger that drives him to kill. So just these kind of realms is where I spend most of my days. So I'm super stoked to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this panel. I think it's going to be a super good time. Everybody loves a good villain, or at least I assume everybody on this panel does.
No, I hate them. Well,
to be open. They're the worst. Yeah, well, it's all right. Well, let's wrap, guys. That's the curtains. So let's start with like just kind of broad. So in your opinion, I want to know like what makes a good villain, just in general, like while you're reading or if you're conceptualizing, what is it about a villain that makes you go, oh, hell yeah. Let's start with Richard on this one.
Oh, blimey. I think there's two things to my mind that make a good villain, and they don't necessarily have to be the same thing in one villain. But the one is a villain who it can be very kind of evangelical about what it is that they're doing or trying to achieve. And so I think a great example of this is Chitwell, AH4's character in Serenity, who's that kind of got that very understated insanity, but very sincere. He's a very sincere character, and he utterly believes in his objective of creating a better world. But he knows, I'll never live there, So it's that kind of that drive to achieve something that is, awful, but he believes that, it's for the greater good. So someone who kind of truly believes in the cause and is willing to do almost anything to achieve it. That's one aspect of it, and that can work in different villains. And then another thing is just a real shit, just someone who you just love to hate, who is just annoying or irritating or just fills you with rage. And I think probably in Empire of the Wolf, Claverer falls into actually both categories.
He's delightfully both.
Yeah. He's a real penis. He's not a nice guy. And he's very easy to hate because of the things that he says and does. But he's also very evangelical as well. And a huge hypocrite, which, a villain who is a hypocrite is easy to hate as well, because hypocrisy is one of the worst qualities a person can have. So, it doesn't have to be all of those things. It can be one of them or even none of them at all. But, to my mind, if you're hitting one of those things, then you're probably on the right track.
I think there are 50 shades of villains in that sense, you do not have this one perfect typecast of a villain. I think for me, one of the greatest villains that there exists is Thanos, because it's when you write a great villain is someone, if history was written from his perspective, he would be a hero. Yes. I think that's something also which makes great villains. I think when I started out, I was working in trying to make a god who we still worship in India as a villain. But then I decided to write him somewhat like a hero. And towards the end, people realized, oh, one second, this is a god which we're okay with. But he is the villain. We didn't realize that. And I think that kind of really makes a villain very cool. The whole idea that he has great motivations.
Yeah. One thing you often hear the villain's the hero in their own mind. I actually try to steer clear of that one, because that it speaks to a certain degree of self-delusion, which is perfect for, as Richard was saying, like a Patria Clover, someone who's very firmly like almost zealot, right? A zealot will do that. But then if you've got like your average shade of villainy, it's basically high desire and low sort of morality in giving a shit about other people and the consequences of your actions. Like, you can boil down a lot of the sort of the more traditional villains, or the, I would say even the more common villains, to just that. I want something and I don't care what's going to happen, what I have to do to get it.
I think there's a different shade of villainy. So I'll answer the question directly. And I think for me, the number one thing is competence. Basically, is the villain making decisions that actually make sense? Is there verisimilitude in the story? And am I reading, like, this person has a goal? And, the thing that comes to mind for me is in Austin Powers, where Dr. Evil's like, all right, I'm going to leave you alone in a very easy to escape room now. And his son's like, just shoot him. He's like, you don't get that this is done, all right? And it, obviously, it's making fun of the trope because there's so many times where the hero can escape, but it's not interesting if there's no conflict, no challenge. And when I'm reading a story and I'm really compelled by the villain, are those moments where I'm like, I don't know how they're going to get out of this. And the villain has done their job and they've made every correct decision. And it really then forces the hero to do whatever it is that they do to outsmart me as a reader or a watcher or whatever. And then I'm like, wow, that was an incredibly well-written story. The villain did their job in pushing the hero to their limits and sometimes overachieving. And then I think just a shade different than what Andy was saying on that last part, but it sparked something in my head. I also sometimes really like villains who just like being bad.
You just described the antagonist of literally every Jackie Chan and Jet Li movie, you know, that was ever made, essentially. I love it. Yeah. Those are great movies. They're villains.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%. And I mean, even the Jackie Chan adventure show, perfectly describes that villain, but yeah, like, I don't know why this is the only one that's coming to my head right now, but Shigo from Kim Possible, who just enjoys being bad. And I'm like, she's a great villain. Like, she just likes it. And then you're having fun, but you're also able to root against her because she knows she's bad. So I think competence in general makes a really strong villain because you're able to follow exactly what they're doing and why. And then sometimes you just want to have fun. Those are separate ideas, but I think both of those things can make a really good villain.
Even Professor Umbridge, now if I can add to that list of Jackie Chan villains, I think even Umbridge is like villainous for the sake of villainy. As in, there is no like reason why she tortures those kids. She just likes it, right? I don't know.
Umbridge is a relatable villain like no other. Like, you know, not all of us have had to deal with someone trying to split their soul into seven pieces and take over the world, but we have all had an awful teacher who's tortured us.
Or a bureaucrat.
I think relatability on some level is really important in villainy, because anyone can be antagonistic. That's another really big point, is there's a difference between a villain and an antagonist. An antagonist is there as a plot device. A villain is there as a moral conundrum more often than not. And Umbridge is a fantastic example of this, for bringing that. So thank you for bringing that up, Gaurav, because I was thinking of one to try and make a difference in the head there. Like, Snape is an antagonist, not a villain.
Yeah.
Voldemort is a villain in his sense that he has got this big old plan to take over the world. Umbridge is a villain in that she believes that what she's doing is right, but she's doing it in a horrific way and leaving lasting damage on basically everyone around her. I think Voldemort,
lawful evil for D&D, right?
Absolutely. Yes. I think we should get out that at some point. We'll do the map of the chaotic versus lawful. I think that comes down to the other two types of villains as well, with like, they just like being bad versus they're competent kind of thing. Like, we've got our chaotic evil and our lawful, definitely.
A really fun kind of villain though is lawful good. Anybody who is like over adhering to whatever, you know, whether it's I'm reading Empire of the Wolf now, so I'm thinking of lawmen, you know, where they're just like justice above all. But the same thing, you deal with faith, religion, you deal with government, ethics, anything, environment, no matter how good the belief system or the system that is guiding, if you adhere to it too strictly, it can lead you to become a villain, because it's like, if you are unwilling to tolerate someone else's faith, someone else's dietary habits, someone else's whatever it is, no matter how small, you can go pretty far down the path to villainy just because you're a huge dick about small things.
You know, that's like a biography of Trump. It's like the starting page of that book.
The guy from Elantris, if you guys have read Elantris, for me it was a few years ago now, but the guy who's essentially trying to make everybody convert to his religion, and the people who are not, like, you know, but he believes what he's doing is complete lawful good for most of that. So that's a very interesting villain as well.
I think one of the interesting conundrums within writing villains is, especially when you have a series or a novel or whatever that has, you know, usually in the fiction that we tend to write has very high stakes, world-ending stakes or whatever. I think one of the interesting conundrums is making sure that the villain, assuming they aren't insane, doesn't go so far that they can't see the inherent wrongness of what they're doing so. One of the things, the lines I had to sort of try and tread in my own fiction is, this is so obviously bad. this is so obviously a bad idea. Why wouldn't they stop? You know, and it's a difficult line to tread. You don't want to go too far down the path unless they're mad.
Yeah, it's the puppy kicking, you know. Trope,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
It's like, well, if I'm going to kick, and I'm sort of grappling with this in the current fantasy series I'm writing, well, if the world is literally going to end if I do this, and in fact, I had to rewrite a huge section of the book I'm currently writing because I realized, I was like, why would he do this? You know, everyone's just going to die, including him.
Maybe he wants that. That's
this
fine.
Is just a objectively bad idea, no matter how evil you are. And it's just making sure that you don't go into the, you want it to be evil and sort of be zealous. And I really like, I read a book series ages ago called Ravenna, which is by Dan Abnett, a Warhammer, it's a piece of Warhammer fiction. They're very, very good books. And in the, I think it's the first one or the third one, I can't remember, but it's not the second. The main bad guy is about to essentially manifest an enormous, you know, demon to the mortal realm, and realizes in the last kind of like hour before, I was like, oh, wait, this was a terrible idea.
and what so have
the,
I done?
The villain ends up helping the good guys to stop it. And I love, that's one of my favorite tropes actually in fiction, is bad guys and the good guys suddenly were forced to work together to solve a mess, usually, you know, having caused by the villain. So that's, you know, something else to bear in mind when you're writing villains, is don't make it so psychopathically stupid that, you know, it's no one is going to believe that any rational person would do this, no matter how bad they were.
Well, I love that agreement when Lex Luthor is forced to work with Batman or Superman in these alternate
universes.
I think that's so much fun to watch, like villains working alongside heroes to like stop this common evil. Like
Lex Luthor's such a good example. When he's done properly, and I mean, probably going to be a question later, but he is one of my all-time favorite villains, again, when written properly, because he is essentially super hyper competent. He's basically Batman, but not Batman. He's like peak human, but he's a villain to Superman, who's essentially a god. And what he does well is that he is so brilliant and so competent, and he is so able to manipulate and you know, change the things around him to suit his will, that again, it pushes Superman, who's bound by very concrete rules of his own actions, to be either incredibly creative or even smarter, or come up with a solution that fits within the rules. So again, for Lex, it comes down to competence. But I think, to your point, Richard, there also is a place for, I mean, the obvious example, since we're talking about Lex Luthor, would be the Joker, right? The truly chaotic evil, just the embodiment of evil, and they want to watch the world burn, these villains, and a lot of people, not always my cup of tea, because I really like when there's more like logic behind it sometimes and what the actions are. But again, the Joker is super hyper competent in what he does. Like, he's not a bumbling fool, he's the opposite. He's brilliant beyond comprehension, and it forces Batman to be at that level of peak human to actually fight against it.
Moderators, MJ.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that I agree. One of my favorite parts of villains is when they're really smart, and then it just sucks when you have to write them because then they're smarter than you. That happens to me a lot.
How do you come up with a smart villain with like an average IQ? Like, that's just, it's a little bit high to ask.
It's very hard. Yeah, in my books, it's like, oh, why aren't there chapters from Clem's perspective? Well, because Clem's fucking smarter than me, okay?
this is something
that happened off page.
This is something that I've found the easiest way to write villains believably is that you don't write from their point of view. Because as soon as you sort of lift off the Darth Vader helmet and you see the face beneath, or as soon as you open the curtain and there's the, you know, the wizard behind the curtain, all of a sudden it makes them a little bit less ominous or omnipotent, or a little bit more. I mean, Darth Vader in the helmet is still the coolest visual that you will ever see. And then you take off the helmet and it kind of waters him down a little bit. And so this is like, you never jump into the point of view of the villains, like their point of view, and you can always kind of keep them a little bit more badass. Now, I will say that the people who can actually write stories from the point of view of the villain and do it well and make, you know, make them believable and understandable. But then at the end of the day, they're still villains that you, you know, you're like, wow, my hat is off to them because I don't know if I have the skill to do that.
No, but on that point, whenever you write a villain's perspective, like you're writing from a villain's POV, like something which I tried and I've read that and I love that, you will realize that those characters never end up being perceived as villains. They will get the tag of anti-heroes, right? Because you've deep dived into their psyche and understanding the cruel actions that they've done. I feel that they never get classified as villains because you have deep dived into their mind. So now they are like these anti-hero concepts. So there is that. So I think even with Steven Erikson did with Anomander Rake, like he doesn't really have a POV in the first few books. And there's this mystique and enigma that gets added around him. I think that is the whole Darth Vader helm thing, because
yeah,
the fact that you do not know what is guiding them, what is their thought process, kind of really adds, lowers the temperature, if I can say, around them.
Yeah. So. And then as soon as you get the I'm your father, and then he actually starts, you know, doing things to bring himself back, and there's the redemption, and then you get the whole Anakin prequel, and all of a sudden the Darth Vader who shows up in, you know, number four, who shows up at the end of Rogue One, this force of awesome evil, he's not as scary anymore.
Well, it's
he's been humanized. That's the thing. Like you humanize someone when you show who they are on the inside. And that's why we don't see Vader's face until right at the end when he's done his, when he's taken back and like fought against the Emperor, he's taken off that mask literally and figuratively. And we see who they are. It's a lot harder to root against someone when you understand them as a human being. That's also why in most media and movies, you see if you have an army or an opposing force of some kind, they will all be masked. They'll have helmets on. You won't be able to see their eyes, because once you start thinking of them as people, it gets a lot more complicated in the brain.
You know that happened in WWF. I don't know if you guys watched that, when Kane took off his mask. I do not know if you know Kane. He wore that red mask, and whenever he took that off, the entire enigma around him being Undertaker's brother, that just like went away, because the mask kind of added to that allure. And
for sure. And also to your point, Andy, it's a classic video game trope. But the second the bad guy joins your team, he's so much weaker. Like, and
that's the bullshit of the world, isn't
it? There's something else to play there, isn't there?
Superpowers. Come on.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about conceptualizing the villains too, you know, when we're writing them. And I know we don't all do, you know, we don't all write from the point of view of our villains. But you still, you know, you got to kind of understand them, know what makes them tick before you can have them as a player on your chessboard, right? So how do you guys plan out your villains for stories? Do you... this probably comes down a little bit too to like the plotter versus pantser thing, which I'm sure will be a piece of the puzzle here. But it can be, you know, as you're fleshing it out while you're drafting too, like how important is it to understand your villain's backstory? Do you, you know, put it on the page? Do you just have it, you know, tucked away in your head? If someone wants to jump in, or I can play school and call on one of you.
I'm happy to, I actually really like writing villains because I just find, well, one of my villains is just really fun. Like he's that like kind of relishes being evil type character. But I think, and this is going to be an underlying theme with literally everything I say ever, whenever I'm interviewed, but a villain always has to be contributing to the story as a whole. And their place should be within making the entire story cohesive, particularly as a foil to the main characters, the protagonist. So typically what I'll do when I'm creating a protagonist is I'll say, okay, what is this person's best quality? Let's say they're really selfless. And then, okay, how do you turn that into a weakness? Well, you exaggerate that to the nth degree, exactly what Andy was saying before. So they're really selfless. Well, maybe that means they're reckless with their own life and they're putting themselves in danger all the time because they're trying to help other people. But as a result, it's hurting their family and it's hurting whatever and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then creating a villain to mirror and reflect that as a foil to show that specific weakness. And then, you know, how do you show that the whatever the morality or the overall value that you're trying to get across with that character, what should they be learning? And formulating a villain that will pry upon that. So it's a direct foil to whatever the themes are of the story. So if the themes are the story, I'll use mine. One of the themes is personal responsibility, properly growing up. So one of my main antagonists is a massive metaphor for what it means to not grow up properly, to take on responsibility, but not properly take on that responsibility in such a way that you're acting responsibly, you're acting well. And it actually turns him into a villain through his actions. So from that perspective, you just kind of extrapolate, right? Like, what would this person do in this situation now that I understand who they are, what their character traits are, and how it's supposed to reflect on the overall themes? And then you kind of just, you have fun with it. You play within the edges, you tease that character out, and then rinse and repeat for every single other character trait. And hopefully it builds an overall really cohesive theme. And your villains are also organic to the story itself, as opposed to shoehorning in, Shigo or whatever into your book, if it doesn't make sense.
I'm here for the ongoing Kim Possible reference.
Well, adding the backstory bit, which you asked, MJ, like, do we put all the backstory in the book or not? I did not know there was a name for it until after I finished the book, but apparently Ernest Hemingway has this method called the iceberg method, which is basically that you don't put the entire part of the backstory in there, but there's a tip, but the tip of the iceberg has a very solid foundation. So I think that really helps that you might not want to put everything there because you might want to have that Darth Vader mask effect. But if you have a strong foundation to it, it turns your villain from a puppet to an AI, as in it's very self-sustaining in that sense. Like, you understand, okay, this might have some backstory which makes sense and kind of gives logic and rationale to his actions. I think that's how, like, the villains, when we are writing, I mean, I don't know about everyone, but they organically grow because you have some reason behind it. You might not want to put that on paper for whatever reasons of the plot. But I think it does really help if you have some sort of roots to the character.
I think the villain, just like any other character, has to want something, don't they? Everything that you write, every character, your protagonist, they want something. How do they achieve it? What are they willing to do to achieve it? And I think the villain is just the same. If you wanted to be reductive about it, usually the villain wants something, and often what the character wants is to stop what the villain wants. And that's how you just sort of achieve that linkage in the story. When I did Claver, I was he wanted to effect the repatriation of the magical powers, the arcana, back to the church initially, and then to himself latterly, as he became more megalomaniacal as the story evolved, and so von Volt and Helena's task becomes to stop him from doing that. But I've done, in my current, where I do have my current WIP, where I do have a villain sort of characters which I'm writing point of view from, his motivation initially is, again, it's sort of a magical, and I want knowledge, I want to know more, I want the power that the knowledge brings, and I want money, I want to make money from it as well. And then things start to spiral out of control, and so I have to learn more to stay on top of it, and I start to losing myself within, you get stuck in a downward spiral, and where you lose control of the situation, and then usually a greater villainy enters the picture from left field, which is another nice way of doing it. But I think ultimately it always comes down to, what does the villain want? Is that thing, and that can be anything, right? That can be, I want to take over the world. Or it can be, I've got two little boys, and we watched Big Hero 6 a day or two ago. And it's great. It's a great movie. And what does the villain want? He wants revenge. His daughter was, he thinks she was killed. Obviously it turns out she wasn't, but he thinks she was killed.
Spoilers!
if you haven't, this movie is about 10 years old, so this is on you.
There's a statute of limitations on spoilers, so
he wants revenge for his daughter, very simple motivation. And the thing that he uses to achieve it makes him in turn intensifies his badness, if you like, his bad qualities, and he goes to greater and greater lengths to sort of achieve that, to the point at which he will, kill. And actually that's a really nice narrative contrivance, because then it means Hero himself, he wants revenge and he wants to kill the villain, and it's up to his friends to sort of pull him back from that brink. So it's a lovely narrative interplay. They both want revenge, except in Hero's case he has a collection of people, good-natured people, who are willing to keep him on the straight and narrow, whereas our villain is a loner. He exists in solitude and does not have that corrective group of, you know, characters or friends to kind of steer him back. And so he continues down the path, whereas I think it's Honeylemon in the movie stops Baymax from killing the villain one hero commands him to, you know, thus beginning Hero's redemption arc. So it's a really well-written movie. It's a really good example, actually, of you know, heroes and villains in a deceptively simple structure. But
Richard, you just gave a much better example of what I was talking about than I was able to.
I'm a lawyer, like Gurav, I'm a lawyer, so we it's our job to put things across in nice
way. I will say I have written so many villains at this point that I can't honestly tell you how I go about doing them. A lot of them just kind of happen organically. Like Sam was saying, you choose something that happens thematically to antagonize or contradict whatever the character's going through. So the last two books that I was working on in the Darkblade series, the theme is fathers and daughters. So there's lots of fathers and daughter characters that show up, and then basically a lot of the antagonists are people who are there to make their lives difficult and sort of showcase to the main character what a father is willing to do for his daughter to sort of show him, hey, be a better father, and just things like that. But then you've got some where it's like one of my favorite antagonist types are just professionals. Like if you look at the Hound from Game of Thrones, he's a little bit like sadistic, but at the end of the day he's just there to do his job. And so you get a lot of like soldier type, you know, military contractor types, knights, these guys who are they answer to the king or to the emperor or whatever, and they're just antagonists. They're not necessarily villains. They serve a really fun role in I'm just doing my job. And so it's like at the end of the day, it comes up to what makes the current story most interesting. I think that is our collective approach. What is the most interesting thing that we could throw up against the character at this present moment? And let's go with it.
Yeah. Louise, do you have anything to add?
Oh, I think maybe the only thing that hasn't already been touched on is the fact that I don't know if anybody else's characters in their novel are all mainly human, or if we're stepping out into different species, different levels of immortality. But for example, a lot of Spark of the Divine revolves around the hierarchy of the gods and whether or not they are able to hold on to their own mantles and their own divinity, and which can be siphoned and stolen, which is kind of the main plot of it. So I, for one, have to look at not only the perspective of a villain who is attempting to siphon said powers to then ascend to godhood, because that's what their goal is to take a mantle for themselves. I also have to... So I've got like your mundane villain with they just want war with their neighboring country because they want more land. And then I've got my villain who wants to steal divinity and become a god. And then I've got a god who is insane and just wants to eat souls. So it's kind of harder to get into his mind because I don't know about you guys, like I've always wanted a bigger house, but I've never wanted to consume the souls of everyone on board the planet. So that can always be a little bit challenging. But
I empathize with the hangry villain always.
I can only write him when I'm hungry.
That's for sure.
There you go.
Louise, I do have something quite. I want to put this down now. I do have something quite similar in my upcoming book, which has been written.
Mine's already out, you'll be hearing from my lawyer. His name is
already lawyer now.
I was just listening to you, and I was like, oh no, it's happened again.
Oh god, here it comes.
This happened to me a few years ago. I was reading I had this idea for it, which is not an original idea. This has been done to death, as you've just heard. I had an idea for a sort of alien race that consumes consciousness. I thought, oh, what a fantastic idea. No one's done this before. And then I literally read Perdido Street Station about a month later, which is a core conceit of the book. And I was like, for fuck's sake. Like,
so one of my best mates was like, are you aware that you wrote the Animorphs? And I was like, no, I didn't. He's like, yeah. And then he started like listing all of the qualities of my character group. And he was like, yeah, this one is this girl. This one is that guy. And I was like, all right, well.
Well, they sold.
What are we doing here? Yeah.
It's like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. You can relate every story ever back to an Animorphs plot. And as we should, Animorphs is fantastic.
As we should. Oh my gosh, I love that though, because whenever I'm talking to groups of kids or whatever, when I do like schools, there's always one kid that asks like, "Well, how do I think of an original idea or whatever?" And I'm always like, "You care about that so much, you bring yourself to it, right? You're the original part." Like, so just
the original takes on things.
That like ideas cannot be copyrighted; only its expression, because of the fact that ideas nowhere are completely purely original. Like some. A part of it would have already been thought of by someone else, either contemporaneously or someone in the past. It's the expression of it that totally makes the difference, I suppose. Mm. So,
well, I mean,
a lot of people say that. Yeah, sorry, Sam, you were saying.
No, I was just going to say, like, the number one way I think any author that I've spoken to, I would imagine everyone on this call, describes their book is by then comparing it to other stuff. Like, that's what you do.
So you sell it.
There's no original, I just stole this idea. But to your point, Gaurav, it's entirely like you can't create a brand new magic. Like there's no, if you're thinking of something that has literally never existed before, that's like coming up with a new color or a new note in music. But how you put those things together is going to create something that we've never seen before, and it's between those lines that's important, not the. Like, if I turn my head, like, I could easily be like, Star Wars meets Avatar The Last Airbender. And you're like, oh, okay. Because elemental magic and, like, cool space stuff already existed. But that's not what the story is, you know?
I love saying that you could give two authors the exact same 10,000-word character outline to this. You know every detail of his backstory. You know where the broad strokes of the story needs to go. And within 500 words, you would have two vastly different stories. And everything from the tone of voice to the, you know, the plot to the pacing, everything would be different. And it is our unique combination of experiences. And like Sam, you were saying, like a new note or a new, you know, color. To come up with something actually that has never been done before is like coming up with something that is like color but different. It's so impossible for the human brain to come up with something utterly new. All we do is find new combinations for things that we know, like colors or music or anything like that. And that is what we can put together, whether it's villains or heroes or worlds or magic systems or languages. That's what makes everything so unique to each creator.
Because like even the Wheel of Time example, so in Hindu philosophy, what we worship in my country and in my family is something called Shakti and Shaivism, which is basically the male energy and the female energy. And we believe in reincarnation. And in fact, our Hindu philosophy is completely based on a concept which is called Wheel of Time. As in like whatever we do, how we are reborn and stuff. So I remember when I was reading Eye of the World for the first time and I'm like, this is very deceptively similar to what I worship in my house. And then I realized
this
that
motherfucker just stole my religion.
Yeah, damn. But I love what he did with it. It was amazing the way he took the concept. But then I remember there was a review of Wheel of Time saying that the magic system is so original. I was like, no, bitch. Like, this is mine. Hello.
Two boring white people. Yes, it was.
So I get that, but I love what he did with it, and that was so amazing that he took something from Hindu philosophy, which none of the Hindus did, and like did something so wonderful with it and created an amazing magic system. And he does credit it. It's not that he tells himself that this is my idea. He said that I'm very inspired by Indian civilization. So that was pretty cool of what he did. So I guess the whole idea, the no idea is original, but it's like different hues. I don't know if you see these lipstick shades that come in and you have all these brand new color names and I have no idea what those colors are because they're different hues. So I think it's something similar even when it comes to ideas, that are just like different hues of the same color.
As a man, my eyes will tell me instinctively there is no difference. There's seven different colors of lipstick.
We're all just everything.
This is scientific.
Exactly.
Well, I, for one, am going to put, I had this idea first as a blurb.
Do it.
So I can say I had a Richard Swan blurb on my next book. So, I'll send you over the paperwork.
Yeah. Sounds good to me.
Perfect. Making deals right here on air.
I'll drop it for you, Louise. No, happy to lend my legal services.
I'll represent myself.
Yeah. I've got a lawyer on retainment. Exciting.
Well, to kind of steer us back to villainy, I want to know how you guys all get into the headspace, the mindset to write your villains. So, like, especially if you do have point of view, scenes, chapters, anything from them, but even just, you know, to write their dialogue, to write a scene that they're in, do you guys use any tricks? Do you have playlists that you put together, or, you know, a meditation exercise, right? Are you method acting your writing? Not mine, maybe, I don't know. but does anyone have like a trick that you use to get into the headspace to write villainy?
Darkness is completely written from the perspective of six villains. Like, there are only villains in my book. So when Andy was talking about
getting
the perspective of characters, I'm like, I only have villains in my story.
Yeah, I just didn't have a rat. That's what I did.
They're not villains. They're perceived as villains, or they're probably stereotypically villains.
Yeah.
But then when you get to understand them, and this is where I think the secret lies to being able to write them, because if they make no sense, I mean, that is a type of villain that is kind of fun to write sometimes. Someone who is psychologically insane and makes no sense. They're not a very complex villain other than whatever their psychosis is. You understand their psychological disorder, the reason why they say three words and then, you know, something else, or what, you know, how they're changing, whatever it is, you need to understand that. But to be able to write them, you just have to understand enough about them that you can say, yes, this person makes perfect sense in their mind. And you can, because you understand what they're thinking, you just sit down and say, yes, this is something a normal human being would say, even as a, you know, as a someone who is governed by morals, more or less, you would never go along with it, but you can understand it.
I've got two answers, and one's a little bit dark, but the first one's light and funny. So I'll start with that. The simple answer is, it's a little embarrassing, but I actually find myself physically acting out a lot of my scenes. Like, a lot of my book is like fight scenes and action scenes, and I used to write in a coffee shop, which I stopped doing for a bunch of reasons, mostly because I'm lazy, but I literally be there and be like, and like acting out like what each person's doing with their body. So like physically embodying the character often helps. How you sit, how you think, how you breathe, how you, it is a very cool shield, how you put yourself in that physical space will also change how you think about that person and how you're able to write in their voice. So that is a trick I use. Like, once I know my villains well enough to, and I have a villain who like is in the story is currently going insane, and kind of putting yourself in that headspace, the darker, like, part of the reason I'm so excited about this panel is I've studied psychology for like on my own time for a decade. It's something I love. It's why I started writing, because it's such a rich well. But to know that there is within us, within every, like, if you read something like the Gulag Archipelago or something, very famous quote, the heart of evil, or evil runs through the heart of all men and people. To know that within all of us, there is something, and there are things that can turn anyone and make anyone, put them in a situation where they could be a Nazi in the death camps and they could be enjoying it. And to really think through that and face that reality, the Jungian psychology would be, you know, integrating the shadow, and doing that work within yourself allows you to, number one, understand yourself a lot more and control yourself a lot more, but also touch the elements of evil that are within all of us, which allows you to write really complex and really deep and really dark villains, but also incredibly bright paragon heroes, because you understand the full depth that is within the human mind. And part of the reason I like writing is because it's you can explore these moral questions in obviously a safe way, but also put them on paper and really test out your ideas. And so that's, you know, studying psychology as its own topic is something I found incredibly helpful to see, like, look, there's been all these atrocities across time, but they're not, they don't come out of nowhere, right? Everyone is a person, and there's always reasons that these things are happening. So being able to just study history and look at what would happen to me in my life to make me do those things, and not just out of force, but maybe even enjoy them. And going to those dark places and confronting it and integrating into yourself really allows you to write incredibly wide spectrum and complex villains.
Or, sorry, playing off the psychology.
Sorry to interrupt. Did I blank out, by the way? I was answering the question, and then suddenly I'm like, one second, what happened? Did I not finish my answer and my tip? And then Andy was talking. Did I give what I do for getting into a different character? Andy, you are the culprit.
You didn't. You didn't even start. I wouldn't have cut you off.
I didn't hear you. Did I cut you off?
Like, I was thinking about, like, I only have villains in my story, and then suddenly I'm like, wait, what happened? Like, why did I not finish my answer? And I kind of blanked out and I glitched out that I do not know
what I don't think I finished.
I'm perfectly fine. I was hoping nodding, I don't end up repeating
sir,
myself.
I feel that.
I will say one thing's very short, and then it can be you. You were talking about psychology, and the Stanford Prison Experiment is such an eye-opener.
Yeah.
It's this experiment where people are put in this condition where at the beginning they're just normal people, and then by the end they are absolutely terrible people. And reading that, it was like a light switch moment. Like, all it takes is normal human beings being put in a very specific environment with very specific conditions, and they deteriorate and become their worst possible selves. So to write a villain, to create a villain, is just who were they to begin with, and what had to happen to them? What were their conditions to turn them into that? And all of a sudden, even all but the most insane villains, and even a lot of the insane ones, because insanity in itself is an explanation, they become so much more understandable, and it's easy to get into their perspective of writing it, because you understand how they got from A to B.
For sure. All right, Gaurav, okay. I want to know. I want to know, though, because I mean, all your
people are villains. Answer.
I need to know, you know, how you come up, like, how you get in the headspace.
I do not have any academic explanation as to, like, how do I get, like, so basically what really works for me, I mean, what really helps is music. So I have, like, a pirate princess character who has no moral conscience. So, you know, there's this band called Neoni and Evanescence. I just, like, get into those songs, and it just really helps me slip into that character, right? And then there's a character who is a torturer. Then I listen to some anime funk music, you know, which are the dubstep remixes. And then you have this lowborn warrior who's, again, like, really evil. Then I just write LOTR theme songs, right, on YouTube. And you have an entire playlist of these soft fantasy music that comes in. So YouTubers are amazing with the amount of compilation and playlists that I've created. It can really set you in the mood. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about writing, is that you can enjoy your split personalities without turning it into an M. Night Shyamalan movie. Like, just like getting into all of these characters and trying to write. So I think that's a lot of fun. But as to any tricks and tips, I think music definitely really helps.
So you're saying
alternate universe where you have no moral conscience. Sorry, Sam, you were saying.
No, I cut you off. I think there's a delay on my end. But you're saying throw on Wake Me Up Inside, and then you're just in the head.
Oh, good, man. Totally.
Channel your inner emo.
Especially the war scenes, I think it's so much. I'm slightly deviating from villainy, but, like, when you're writing the battle scene, the music sometimes really. Two Steps from Hell is an absolute recommendation for writing battle scenes.
Oh my gosh, I love Two Steps from Hell for writing too. Yeah.
Done.
Richard, Louise, either of you guys have tips?
I think it's been said mainly. I don't really have a specific process for the villains in general, but I'm definitely a playlist girly as well. You got to have your safe music and your battle music, I am a little bit unique in the sense that my story is being ripped from real life D&D campaigns. I do actually go back and I steal the same playlists that we had at the table. So I'm like, oh, what, this was this big battle with so-and-so. I go back and I like go through the little playlist that we were using, and I pull up the same music to try to like transport me back there.
I did think I was just, Sam kind of said it all very nicely already. It was just the fact that we're all capable of great evil. You know, how often have you logged into you know, Grand Theft Auto and just blown up a bunch of people walking down the road?
You know, I just use that as a driving game.
It's a the driving
game. Harder just to drive properly. Yeah, just stay in the lane.
Oh, I can't. Right? Only thing I do in Cyberpunk at the moment is just shoot people in the street. And for about 10 minutes, then I turn it off.
I use Valhalla as like just a fishing game at the moment because my four-year-old is playing with me. So we've called it Viking Ship Simulator 3000.
Oh, lovely.
I love it.
We float down rivers and then we get off and we pick flowers and shit. So it's real fun.
I'm not going to lie. That sounds delightful.
It's pretty good.
I want to highlight this comment from David Hopkins here. Difference between hero and villain is the worst 24 hours of your life. I really like that.
Is that referencing The Killing Joke? I imagine it is. If not, then...
It's from a movie, I think.
Batman's Killing Joke, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, it could be. I just thought it really pointed out, you know, some of the stuff we were talking about, right? Where it's like the capacity is in... you know, theoretically in all of us. And
yeah. That's it. The Nazis didn't come from nowhere, did they? Yeah, we're just regular people, right. All of them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about something that's maybe unpleasant about writing villains, for sure. Because, you know, I think it can be fun to write from a villain perspective sometimes, you know, to Richard's point, you know, you do have your times when you go in and you are, you know, just... causing chaos in a video game.
Indulging your id, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, you're indulging you know, something that is you know, it's doesn't have consequences because it's not real life and it's fine. But sometimes the villains that we create are really abhorrent in some way, right? And I don't even mean just like abhorrent in the normal way. Like most of our villains, we write fantasy and science fiction, right? Like our villains are actually committing murder. Probably all of them, right? But I mean like abhorrent in a way that is not as normal for the genre necessarily, right? Like they are, maybe some of them are bigoted, maybe some, right? Like they just have something really awful. How do you toe the line between making your characters hateable and making them relatable or like feel like
thank you for rhyming that. I was really hoping
thank you. Well, I know I had to.
If you hadn't rhymed it, I would have been
been very upset.
Disappointed in you as a writer, to be perfectly honest.
Thank you. I'm glad I passed the test. But I mean, do you toe that line or do you even bother towing it, right? Do you find it more valuable to take them boom straight into hateable? Or the other way around, do you really make sure that your villains are more on the relatable side? Anyone thoughts?
I think it's a really interesting question because these days in writing in this day and age, I think we probably have some of the least evil villains that have ever existed. And I'll tell you what I mean by that, because if you read fiction from 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, whatever, a lot of the time you would have staggeringly racist villains, for example, or, you know, very occasionally you would have one who was like a child molester or something. But I think in this day and age, when we're writing, well, certainly my approach to writing fiction is, and I'll use sexual assault as an example as well, right? It's what better signifier of evil, you know, than rape, you know, of course, it's a profoundly evil thing to do. But I think we've kind of got to the stage in fiction, and whether it's just a kind of maturation of the genre or something else, but I think there's an awareness now that a lot of people, obviously predominantly women, you know, face sexual assault in their lives. All loads of them, you know, a staggeringly high percentage of women.
97%.
And I think... I think we as writers, certainly as male writers, I'd like to think as male writers, I don't know this for a fact, but I think it used to be the case that it was included in fiction very de rigueur. You know, you don't have to go back that far in fantasy fiction to find the villain is committing sexual assault left, right, and center because he's a bad guy and that's what bad guys do. And I think these days we're more rightly, in my opinion, were more sensitive around it because, and same with racism, people of color experience racism all the time. And you think, well, when I'm writing my fiction, there are lots of ways to make a person evil. There are people reading these books have to deal with this shit in real life, often in profoundly affecting ways, life-changing ways. Do I really want to just lightning rod this into their brains? You know, who knows what you could be unearthing in so writing. So I think it's more common now to avoid things that we would traditional signifiers of evil, right? You know, rape, murder, not murder. Everybody gets killed all the time. In fact, weirdly, that seems to be the most allowable form of evil. I don't know why, because it's arguably the worst thing you can do literally kill somebody. But I think we're more aware of that. Or it's not to say I think it shouldn't be included at all ever, because ultimately those things do happen and they still do happen, and fiction is a reflection of reality. I think what was happening, hitherto, and probably still is to a degree, I don't know, is it was being included all the time, almost as a kind of, oh yeah, well, that's a bit of rape, because that was just a done thing. And then I think now we're a bit more careful about, okay, well, if there is a rape, let's explore and examine that, and maybe forewarn the reader that it does grapple with those themes. So I do think we are avoiding them, those things, for the right reasons, but it's also making us more creative in how we apply our villainy, how we make the villains, how are we going to make them evil? If we're not going to have race as an issue in this world, if we're not going to have frequent sexual assault, if it is going to be an egalitarian society between men and women, how do we make the villain evil now? Like, we can kill a bunch of people. This is great. He's a dick. He can do that. And I don't think anybody wants to read about, say, paedophilia, for example, because that's just genuinely horrible. And so only the kind of the edgiest, most horrible horror novels might have something like that in it. And of course, again, that does happen. That is a real thing, obviously. But I don't think anybody finds that a palatable topic, and I think that would be immediately erased by any sane editor from a book, and obviously rightly so. And so we do have to kind of think about quite creative ways about how is this villain, evil. And of course, within fantasy and sci-fi, we can draw on all sorts of made-up things to, help the contrivance as well. He's evil because he wants this particular magic, for example, and so he'll do anything to get it. But I do think we have, you read like a Stephen King novel, and you'll see the N-word in the first three pages. And it's like, it's quite arresting reading that now. Because, these days, I don't think people go for that like low-hanging, evil signifier. I think we're a bit more kind of thoughtful about how despicable our characters are.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting when you speak about sexual assault as a...
You never said it, by the way.
Sam said it earlier. I know he said it earlier.
Brian, why don't you just say it?
I nearly complimented on his use as well.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go on.
So I think with that is the joke. So what happens is also a reflection, as Richard said, about the reality we live in. So right now in India, we are fighting a case for criminalization of marital rape. It's a crime in most countries. But what marital rape is, basically, it's spousal rape, which is not considered a crime in India at the moment. Okay, we're fighting to criminalize it. Now, in the Indian mythological text, there was a princess who was Draupadi, who was married off to 5 husbands and relegated to poverty, right? And that matter is completely glossed over, not realizing that that was set in a patriarchal society. So, and since it's a reflection of our times, there is a scene which involves this idea of how a princess who's been suddenly forced to sleep with 5 brothers at the same time, what kind of torment does she go through? Now, when Indians read this book, they related to it a lot, and they were like, that is something that's amazing. It's a reflection of what's happening, what we're fighting in the Supreme Court for. Now, interestingly, some of the Western readers, the American readers, let me take that as an example. When they read it, they're like, why is this there? Why do we have to subject this woman to such an assault by 5 different people at different points of time? But again, that is not written as an assault, because at that point of time, people didn't even believe that this was assault. This is something which is there in a mythological text. So that also context determines a lot of things as to why we're including this. And there again, we have to be respectful, but we also bring out the issues which are prevalent in our time. So when you ask a question about to toe the line, that line might be very different depending on the culture where you are when you're reading it. You know, for Indians, the issue of marital rape is a big thing. But let's say in US, when people have no idea, people will obviously, okay, this is obviously a crime. So they might think that, okay, why is this there? You know, do we really need to include it? So I think that really matters. Sorry, Andy, you were saying.
No, I was going to say the culture, but then also the time. Something that was a hot button issue today was not even on people's radar 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago. You know, you see Sean Connery casually talking about, you know, smacking a woman to keep her in line. And for his day, most normal thing in the world. We watch that clip now and we're like, oh my God. So it's just, you know, understanding the context, huge. Understanding what goes into the creation of the character and the origin of these things. Like if I had gone into reading your story with no notion of this marital rape struggle, it might have been a little bit more shocking for me. But if I read it and I know this context, all of a sudden it's like, well, this is a very interesting, obviously it's still terrible, but it's interesting to see how it's reflecting something that's going on right now. Another great example is in K.S. Vioso's, Chronicles of the, I remember Bitch Queen because that's what it was called, but I think it's the Wolf Queen. They changed the title. Or something like that. But her whole thing is based on the context of the Philippines. And so her whole character dynamic is super, super native or organic to what it's like for them. And for me reading it, I was like, I didn't understand that. So I messaged her, what's going on here? Why I didn't understand it. And she explained it to me and it made it so much more interesting once you understand the context behind it. So that's the same thing with when it comes to understanding villains. You kind of have to understand who the writer is because that tells you a lot about where they're coming from and their inspiration behind it. But to play off what Richard was saying earlier, we have sort of elevated our level of villainy to be much more relatable, but then there's villains and there's villains in the sense that for every, you know, sort of highbrow, is he really bad? Are they really bad? There's always going to be the bully, you know, the Biff from Back to the Future, the rapist, the one that's very, very easy to hate because you can often just drop it in there, even just the hint of it. And then immediately you're on the side of the character who is being mistreated. So this is where you kind of get those shades of gray as exactly. Yeah. Alex was the one who
inspired. We had that comment earlier.
So this is something that I had to do with the Hunter from the Darkblade series. This guy is an assassin, half demon, cursed dagger. None of those things are good. He butchers 300 to 400 people in the opening book. The only reason that people are okay with it is because I spend time showing you who these people are and how they're so much worse. So you use the old school style villains that are very much, you know, the Snidely Whiplashes or the was it Thulsa Doom or the very sort of black and white villains to paint most of the picture, and then you use the sort of the highbrow intellectual type villains to create even more depth to the character or to the story.
Yeah, I think as far as I'm concerned, every single word that I write has to serve the story. And if it serves the story to make a villain, you know, bigoted or a puppy kicker, or like, this is true for my book, but I don't anticipate, you know, every villain I write necessarily is going to be a romanticized villain where, you know, to Gaurav's point, they become an anti-hero. Like some people are bad, rotten, evil people and are doing evil things. And Richard, to your point, it's funny to me to think that we can have someone like casually blow up a planet or murder 100,000 people. And we're like, that's fine. But then if I'm putting myself in and I'm really trying to dive into the psychology of that character, if I'm writing a character with cosmic powers who can wipe out a continent with a thought and then them think to themselves, well, I can't say these words that people aren't going to like no one's going to stop that person or that villain from doing that horrible action because that's what they would do, right? That's the verisimilitude as Ryan wanted us to say in the chat.
Ding, ding.
And when I'm writing again, if it serves the story, like from the very top with competence of the villain, whatever they're going to do that's going to make sense within the story, that's going to keep the reader engaged, and it's going to say like, yeah, this is an evil person. This is like, this person's murdering and raping and pillaging. They might say, if, you know, mudblood, if it's Harry Potter, which is the bigoted derogatory term, it would be weird if that didn't happen. So that's kind of my view, is that the villains have to be like, if you're writing your villain in line with your story, then, you know, it doesn't have to be a lovable or relatable villain. It doesn't have to be a villain that people like are rooting for in the back of their heads or understand necessarily what their motivations are. And that might be the role of that person.
I think historically women's pain has been used as a literary device, and it is bullshit, and we know better now. I will DNF a book that has sexual assault for no reason. I have lived it. Everyone I know has lived it. And to see and hear the words tossed out casually, like it doesn't ruin somebody's life, is quite frankly distressing. And I think in this day and age, the ability to portray somebody as a bad person shouldn't have to come from portraying violence that is real life violence. So I would much rather see somebody blow up a planet than have them be like, oh, yep, they did that to a living, breathing person, because that just shows me that the writer doesn't fully grasp just how horrific that is to someone who has lived it. So if you haven't lived it, maybe take a little bit of a step back on that one. I guess it's hard because there's two sides to everything, right? Like you can't say write what you know, because most of us are writing about demons and cosmic powers, stuff like that. But at the same time, someone like GRRM, like George Martin, for example, I stopped reading those about three or four books in because it was getting lazy. There's too much. You don't need to have that happen to every single female character. Mm. You've made your point. And I think like using that, or fridging in another way, like when you kill off a female character just to give the male character something to do, is also incredibly lazy. And I think most people are better than that these days. So it's honestly, in the indie community, I see it a lot more, people stepping away from that and not sort of relying on those tropes, because some tropes are good. Like everyone wants to see, you know, good triumph over evil. For the most part, I've seen a lot of grimdark. Actually, I wasn't aware how big grimdark was. But I think as writers and as fantasy writers in general, it's a lot nicer these days to experience having villains with more and more unique ways of showing that they are in fact villains and not just pieces of shit.
Right. Well, and that's something I kind of want to talk about too, is, you know, what about your thoughts on making a villain more, you know, we've talked a lot about the different types of villains, right? You do have your, you know, chaotic evil villains, your lawful evil, your lawful good, I think it was Andy that made the point about lawful good can be a villain. What do you think about giving a villain like a quirky or unexpected trait or something, using comedy, right? Is there a space for that, or do you use that at all in your work? Do you find that that runs the risk of humanizing the villain too much? Just kind of what are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends on how many villains you have in your book. If you have multiple levels of villainy, if you've got people who are low-level henchmen-y, kind of guys, I do have in Spark of the Divine, I have a few different layers of villains, like I mentioned before. And there is actually multiple scenes where some levels of villain interact. And one of the villains is clearly higher up and kind of, you know, puts the lower level villain on his ass a couple of times. And so to me, that's funny because fuck that guy. But you know, it doesn't make the lower level villain any less scary, because the higher level villain is just even scarier. So right. I think as long as you're doing it without costing them their scary factor, then it can be very useful in the plot and in story device.
I agree and second that. I think the number of villains kind of really allows you to have different layers of humor. There can be humor, which is called dry wit, which is the way they talk, and it can have slightly Woodhouse touch to it, and that's funny in its own way, the dry British humor. But there can also be this adorable psychopath. Like one of the characters is, I feel, inspired by the latest iteration of Moriarty in the Benedict Cumberbatch series. Like, he is completely goofy, but that does not at all inch away from the terror that he inspires. So I think that was so beautifully done. And he creates these situations. So that was amazing. So I think the number of villains that you have, you can like, I don't think it humanizes them per se. I mean, obviously it totally comes down to the writing, but I think the quirks can in fact make them even more, you know, I don't know, terror inspiring or terrorizing. So I think that bites his nails while killing somebody, I think that can, if you write that well, it can, every time he decides to bite his nails, you are like, okay, something bad is really going to happen.
Right, you're like on edge.
Yeah, I think the Sin City movies from the mid-2000s did that really well. I think Elijah Wood's character, it definitely was quirky and funny. I use comedy a lot in my writing, and I think it's a very light touch. Like, I think Marvel is a good example of going way overboard, like recent Marvel, where it everything gets watered down. But I think you can definitely have a villain who's comedic, and it doesn't necessarily humanize them, although obviously you run that risk of making them a fan favorite. But
if villain, why hot?
Yeah,
exactly. My central thesis, make them hotter and let them win sometimes.
But that's exactly it, right? Like, I guess it depends on what you mean by humanizing. Like, unless you're going to make someone so inhumanely evil that they can't, there's no redeeming quality, like a truly satanic figure, then someone's going to latch onto something. But I think humor can be a very powerful tool. Again, it comes down to competence, right? It's the difference between a bumbling fool and Jackie Chan, who I think is like the maybe the only example of incredibly competent and also hilarious, because like I grew up watching Jackie Chan movies, and he'll do the same stunt 100 times, 200 times to get the exact right motion so that it's incredibly competent and also funny. And I think if you can do that with a villain too, it doesn't make them any less terrifying because you know they're going to be
Richard got a visitor.
He broke the fourth wall.
Someone came in.
I think with humor you run the risk of weakening them, and I do mean this with humor at large. Like the one thing that made Moriarty a great villain is that we knew he was Moriarty. So even though the humor was there, we knew it was a veneer because the name Moriarty rang in our head from the beginning. I cannot think offhand, there could be someone. I cannot think of a villain, an effective villain that is also humorous. Humor is a very charming, a very attractive, but not a very strong character personality trait. You do not
villainize from Killing Eve, like just one off the bat. Like
she's amazing.
But is she like, yeah. But so they contrast her humor very much with the unpredictability of it. Mm-hmm. So her humor is not the thing that makes her dangerous or scary or ominous. It's a great humanizing element, but it is not a tool to make her a terrifying villain. So you have to balance it really, really well, and you run the risk of weakening. And I am all for using, I mean, Loki, all the times that he was funny, he was still a great villain in the Avengers movies. They used comedy to amazing effect, but at the end he lost, and you were never like, oh man, he really should have won. It was clear from the beginning he was going to lose because he's, you know, it's going up against the Avengers. Whereas someone like Darth Vader, you give Darth Vader a line that has people chuckling, and all of a sudden you've lost the thing that makes him terrifying. So there's, again, it comes down to there's villains and there's villains. There are some where you can absolutely get away with, you know, the occasional quippy one-liner, even a really funny quirk or a dry wit or personality. But if you start getting too much into the kind of funny that we've sort of come to associate with like rom-coms or even, you know, the more comedic action movies, you instantly lose what we as a society have come to see as the strength of a, you know, of a strong bad guy character or bad woman character.
I think that's how they messed up Kang.
Sorry.
You guys. Too much comedy, which did not land right. The Kang, who's a Thanos of phase 4 or phase 5 of Marvel movies, I think there was the comedic element, though he's a great actor, Jonathan Majors, at least in terms of his acting skills, but the comedy element just did not matter. It became too humorous, and that diluted Kang's fear value. So bang on money.
Yeah, and he went really hard into the quirkiness, right?
Yeah.
Really leaned into, I'm going to be a quirky bad guy, whether that was his choice or whether that was the director's choice, whatever. But it really lost the power compared to a Thanos. Thanos, not a single funny line in the whole thing, and he was, say what you will about him, he was an amazing antagonist to the whole thing. Kang, from the beginning, especially the, what is it, He Who Remains, he was never a great villain. He was an antagonist, fine, but honestly, the Renslayer character was a better villain in the Loki TV show. And, you know, the faceless, whatever, the elders or whatever they were, they made better villains. But as soon as you ripped away the mask, the power kind of diminishes, especially when you lean too hard into the quirky. So this is something anime does a lot. Anime loves giving their villains one quirk or two quirks or something that makes them, you know, super unique and maybe a little bit funny. It's more expected in anime because you can get away with a lot more because it's just a different style of storytelling. In Western storytelling, you can't get away with it much.
But I think, Andy, to your point, overusing comedy will kill almost any character. And I think the modern Marvel is a perfect example of that, but there's very few characters who can, Spider-Man's a good one, a good example, where the charm of the character is the talking and the quippiness, but overusing comedy will kill the strength of any character, right? Like, you want to know that someone, and that's why I said, like, the lone example I can think of where that competence and funniness stays high is Jackie Chan, where his films are hilarious and what he does is hilarious, but he is also an absolute master of everything that's happening in that scene. And even, like, you know, if I think about Spider-Man comics or movies or whatever, when times get serious, the quips go away, right? Yes. And so I think your point is well taken across the character spectrum.
Awesome. Well, we're getting close to time here, so I want to wrap us up with a fun one, which is just for everyone to talk about, you know, a couple, one or two of your favorite villains in fiction, and what do we love about them?
Tywin Lannister. Like, I think it was my password for the longest time across my life. It is no longer a password. Do not write.
But I gotta find the one account where you forgot to change it.
It is for his MySpace.
MySpace.
But I think, and not only the character, even Charles Dance in the show did so much justice to the character with his mannerisms, the way he's so brutal, and the fact that he has a motivation, a very misguided motivation of keeping his family honor intact while ignoring the very family he's supposed to take care of. So the different layers of villainy involved in that was just amazing. And it's like when he does the Red Wedding, he tells Tyrion that, is it better to kill few people in a wedding than an entire army, right? And that line makes so much sense that, you know, obviously only few people are dying, but the way they are killed obviously makes you hate Tyrion. So in this whole context, the multiple layers that were there in his villainous arc was just something marvelous. And of course, there's Umbridge, because she reminds everyone of a teacher that they have had, especially if you've grown up like me in a convent school. So you've always had one of those nuns who just love the king. And in India, around my time, there was corporal punishment, and now it's all over. And she had this amazing idea of putting a pen between my fingers and just like pressing it. Every time I got some art drawing wrong, yeah, I was like, sorry. Okay, that sounds like really morbid for you. It's very common. It kind of went away. It was funny.
It did not. Picturing
very Catholic school, yes.
Very good. See, she used to take a rubber band and like take it and like leave it this way. It was like, it was amazing the things she used to do. So when you read Ambrish, you're like, yeah, this just makes so much sense. So I think that way, like Louise pointed out at the very beginning, that an amazing little villain, you know. So yeah. Sorry, there was too morbid. Like it was, it's so, funny.
And I heard
you know, so, you know the part where Ambrish makes her do the fucking stabbing in the. I was like, I didn't bring up that part because I didn't think anyone would actually relate to that bit. But apparently, apparently people do. So
yeah.
Cool. Jesus well, Christ.
That became dark. I mean, it's a villain panel, so obviously.
But yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
I would love to. I go back to classic Disney for my favorite villains, mainly because they were all camp as fuck and they all had great songs. Scar is definitely up there as one of my.
Jeremy Irons.
Be Prepared. What a fantastic song, honestly. Fantastic and, you know, song. Like he had a plan. It didn't go great with the whole consumption of food. The hyenas kind of fucked up the ecosystem there, but, you know. He had a decent reason for wanting to be king. And in the original version, like the pre-Disney one, he had, I can't remember how to pronounce it, but his name before he got his scar translated to garbage. So, like, why are you going to name one kid Mufasa, which means king, and then you're going to name your other kid garbage? That's, you're setting him up to fail.
Like, no
Ursula, again, another one. Fantastic. Look at her. She's a queen.
The best
queen,
villain song,
honestly.
I think. Poor unfortunate souls.
Beautiful. And I think the one great mistake that Disney did, like I get it, but there was so much lore they could have gone into for Ursula. I mean, the original Little Mermaid, Hans Christian Andersen's written, is dark as hell. Like, you know, I don't know if anyone's actually read it, but like, how do I say this? The mermaid goes to, she gets her legs and she goes to go see her prince that she's fallen in love with, but he's actually got a girlfriend already who's just a normal girl that's not the sea witch, and they're married, so she's like, oh, well, I can't get him to fall in love with me, I'm fucked. And the sea witch goes, oh, okay, well, if you stab him with this dagger and kill him, then I'm not going to take your, I won't take you for another 1,000 years. You can live for another 1,000 years before you do. And so she takes her dagger and she goes to go and kill the dude, and then she can't do it, so she explodes into bubbles and dies. So yeah, kind of glad Disney didn't go that route because it's a bit
the classic Hans Christian Andersen
happy ending. Yeah, yeah, a little bit more traumatic in that sense. But I guess like the entire backstory of Ursula having been living in the palace, and you know, in some versions of the legend, she's Triton's sister. She was meant to be first in line, and he usurped her. There's a lot of like different levels of layering that you could add to that story. And, you know, I think she's a very interesting character. It's like that iceberg thing we said before. Like, you can tell that there's a lot more going on, and they don't necessarily have to go into it to make her interesting, because you can tell that it's there. But, yeah, less of a – you can't really get the songs going in fiction, so – more of you guys need to write songs for your villains. I'll be waiting. I want to see the lyrics.
I thought the best villain I read in fiction was it was Peter Hamilton's Confederation duology years and years ago. But in the first one of those, he is a villain. It's not really a villain. It's an alien, but it's a really horrible. It's a very arresting scene. It's it's from the perspective of the alien. The alien is called Morning Light Mountain. And it's the alien is formed of thousands and thousands of what are called motiles, these kind of living extensions of it. And they capture a team of space explorers and vivisect them. But it's from the perspective of Morning Light Mountain. So Morning Light Mountain doesn't know what these human beings are. The dramatic irony, of course, is that we do. We know exactly who they are, what the characters' names are, and their relationships. And so Morning Light Mountain describes the process of vivisecting one of the scientists, and then one of the other creatures is creating this horrible noise, which we know to be screaming and, you know, anguished wailing. So it's a profoundly affecting scene. And I think one of the great efficacies of that scene is Morning Light Mountain has no comprehension of what it's achieving, and also B, we know that therefore any kind of revenge that we take, because obviously we're rooting for the human protagonists. Morning Light Mountain doesn't understand or care about our anger, so we can't kind of score points off him emotionally either. It just, it's completely, well, you know, whatever. It just doesn't have the concept of anger, anguish, fear. And so, you know, when we think of two human antagonists or two human kind of opponents, Game of Thrones is a good example of the family details. And so if this family member dies, well, we all have family members, so we know what it's like to lose one, or at least we can imagine it. Morning Light Mountain does not have any of that. And so it makes him a terrifying villain, because it's, you know, there's no empathy, there's no remorse, there's just nothing. It is just an implacable foe. And so that was a very frightening villain to read, actually. I remember reading that one scene and being quite affected by it.
I'm gonna give a little shout out to Star Wars again. We've mentioned Darth Vader a couple of times. I don't know if any of y'all have read the Darth Vader comic that Dark Horse put out, but there's this one scene where Darth Vader is like surrounded by like 10,000 Republic troops and tanks and spaceships and stuff. And they're like, we have you surrounded. And he's like, no, all I see are dead men. And he proceeds to rip through them all. Like, Darth Vader is probably one of the greatest villains of all times in terms of just like sheer power and ominousness. But mad shout out to my boy Darth Maul for just the cool fact. Just that moment where he pops on the screen and double lightsabers it. That was like my 14-year-old brain was blown.
It was incredible.
Love the Phantom.
I was actually terrified. I had nightmares. I was like 9 or 7 or something when I saw that movie. I'd say for me, the top villains would be Lucifer from season five of Supernatural. Just incredibly compelling and understandable, but all at the same time, like, this is the devil. But every single scene, I think the actor's name is Mark Pellegrino, that he was in. You're sucked in and drawn in, and you understand, the Lucifer from Paradise Lost, John Milton's epic poem, which is incredibly difficult to read. But you understand the romanticized Lucifer, and it ties the themes of the show together so incredibly well that every single time I watch it, I'm just blown away, even though I know exactly what's going to happen. And then Azula from Avatar: The Last Airbender, who is just top tier, incredibly powerful. Again, obviously the theme of the night for me for some reason, but super competent and
super hot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like Shigo.
There you go. Yeah.
Like Shigo,
yes. But yeah, exactly. But, you know, hotness aside, for if we can, it's hard.
we can't. Nor should we.
Every time she was on screen, you're terrified for what's going to happen. Like, you're like, all right, everyone's in danger. Anyone could die. I've seen this show 50 times. And still, the second that character comes on screen, your back is up. And I think that's a sign of a really, really good villain. Again, someone that pushes the entire, you know, protagonist cast to new limits to really overcome.
Like Avatar as a villain as well. The first Avatar movie by James Cameron, the villain really pushed everyone to act up. The soldier, the general, right? Quattridge. I think that was
Quattridge.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to talk about the Airbender movie, and I'm like, well, there's no Airbender movie.
Yeah, I was very.
They pushed us all to hate something.
I've never heard anyone reference the James Cameron movie in this is also Richie Newgrand.
Can I just point out as well, Charlie Cavendish in the chat said thoughts on David Tennant as Kilgrave and Jessica Jones. One of the scariest villains of all time. Gave me legitimate nightmares for probably a week.
Marvel does not have a better villain than Kilgrave.
Frankly, David Tennant in anything.
Couldn't pick a better actor to do it. Like David Tennant coming straight off the Doctor. Like I look at him and I see the Doctor. So I'm like, oh, it's David Tennant. And then my brain was like, no, you can't trust this man ever again. And then I see him as the Doctor and I'm like, what are you hiding, Kilgrave? And that is the mark of not only a seriously well-written villain, but also an incredible actor as well. Those kind of actors that can make you hate them for a very long time, even though you know it's not really them. which if we go full circle comes back to Umbridge as well. I see Umbridge and stuff and I'm like, no, I hate you. She could be playing Mother Teresa and I'll be like, no, she's going to kill someone at some point.
Yeah, so when she was cast as the queen in The Crown, I had a lot of difficult time to reconcile, you know, these two characters. I'm like, okay, this is not working out.
You're not the queen.
If Daniel Radcliffe had been cast in that, everybody would have been like, all right, what is coming next? You know who was like a really spectacular like antagonist slash villain? I don't know if any of you have seen the TV show Money Heist, the Spanish show Casa de Papel. The character Berlin, he is one of the protagonists, but it's very clear from the beginning that he's kind of a psychopath and you never know what he's going to do. And already the show itself is super unpredictable, but then they lean into it with this character and he is always smiling. He's always very polite. And you are terrified of what he's going to do. And then they just gave him his own spin-off show and they leaned into it even more in the sense of he is running this heist crew. And what is he going to do next? Because he has the power. Like that is a character. My wife and I, we just binged both of those and we were like, oh my God, you know, you're nervous and you're tense the whole time. Like that's a really good villain character.
MJ, who's your favorite character?
Ooh. Like, yeah, I should have prepared for this. I mean, gosh, a lot of ones you guys. I know, right? You've tricked me. I mean, I love. I tend to really love a smart villain, and particularly a smart villain where they are the hero in their own story, which I know Andy disagrees with. It seems like, but like, so for me, like, if I'm thinking Marvel, like, Killmonger is like one of my favorites, right? Where it's like, he's got a point, right? Oh, but also like what he's doing is not but also I get it.
I get it. Maybe doing all that though. Yeah,
the kind of villain that makes me question my own goodness is I guess that my favorite kind of villain, right? Where it's like, oh, if I was put in the same situation, I might make these same choices and end up the villain in the story, right? So yeah, that's one of my favorites. Or if we're going Game of Thrones, Littlefinger was like my favorite character in that. like to the point that in the show, when he died, I got about 15 messages from friends going, ha ha, because they all knew I loved him. Not because I thought he was like a good person or anything, but just because
I did not believe that scene at all. Okay, if Littlefinger was for true, he would say trial by combat. Like this is just ridiculous.
Oh yeah. But it's like, you know what I mean? It's you know something interesting is gonna happen when they show up, right? Which I think for me is another mark of a good villain. But yeah, I think this has been a really interesting conversation. I think we've gone a lot of dark and fun and all the places in between places. And so to kind of close out, I wanna have everybody share where our listeners, viewers can find them online so they can follow up with you and check out your books and meet your villains. So let's just go around round table. We'll start with Louise. Where can everybody find you online?
See, this is a little bit annoying because my normal name was taken on Twitter, so I've got a whole bunch of random ones for me. So that's real hard for everyone. But it's L.A. Holland author on Twitter. Louise Holland author on Instagram and Louise Holland dot author on TikTok because, you know, I just had to make it a round trip of annoying. But other than that, you can find Spark of the Divine on Amazon and on my own website, which is kamoribooks.com.au. I recently added a little page on there that had all of my little cute interviews and reviews and stuff that I've done. So this video will be on there too once I can figure out how to do the HTML because it takes me about 3 hours to do a single one. So
yay, we all have to learn to be web designers.
Yeah. Yeah, right? I didn't sign up for that. I just wrote a book. I think it's an essential skill
for any debut author who's trying to like make it. You have to know how to make your website. I think it just goes without
saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not my space anymore.
YouTube video. Yeah. All right, Sam, where can we find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Elements of Time Book. I'm also on Twitter at, I have to open up my Twitter and tell you,
S. Paisley.
Yeah.
I type Sam and then I'm like, damn it. Then I go back.
I made it like 2 weeks ago. So it, brand new to
we
me.
We bullied Sam into getting Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. A bunch of
peer pressure.
New author friends were like, it was the correct bullying tactic, but it was necessary. My website's elementsoftime.ca because I am Canadian. So you can find me there. And then thank you, Andy. But yeah, I
shout out Canada.
Exactly. Andy and I are about 3 hours and like 3,000 miles apart right now, but still in the same country. But yeah, so Instagram at Elements of Time Book, Twitter at S Paisley Author, elementsoftime.ca. And yeah, please do reach out. Please consider, you know, checking the book out. If this is what it looks like, and if you can't see it, I'll duck down. Okay, great. That's the cover, but it's actually words.
Perfect. All right, Richard, where can we find you?
Twitter's probably best. Richard_S_Swan. Swan with one N. And if you can't find my books after finding my Twitter profile, then you don't deserve to be on the internet.
There you go. I got you, Richard.
Good man. Thank you.
Showing it off.
Legend.
Gaurav?
So you can find me on Twitter on MohantiGaurav7. And this is the embarrassing part. My Instagram account sounds like a fan account for George R. R. Martin because it's called The King Beyond the Wall. I got that without any number. So I was like, I'm not letting go of this handle. If I ever run the JRRM in a call, I'm like, see, like you have to take a picture with me. So it's the king beyond the wall. And my website is www.gauravmohanty.com. Please visit it. I did like 2 hours of YouTube tutorials to like even make one page. So yeah.
Make his work worth it.
Yeah. And this is from the darkness. So yep. All right.
Awesome. Scale of 1 to 10. I just have to know. Scale of 1 to 10, how dark are we talking? For Sons of Dark.
Just one level darker than A Song of Ice and Fire, I suppose. So 6. Not your Mark Lawrence, but somewhere.
Okay. I was hoping for a 10, but I'll settle for a 6.
I'm writing on something which is mythological and religious in India, so I don't want to be pelted here by stones. I'm taking baby steps towards violence.
Taste by very guns.
Good. Yeah. And I guess I will say that you can find me, I'm everywhere as just Andy Pelequin. My website's andypelequin.com, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, everything is Andy Pelequin. You can see my name here. That's how you spell it, not how you pronounce it, but that's fine.
Oh, my cat has the zoomies right now and he is attacking my hand because I'm gesturing.
I love him.
Talking.
Bring him up.
Right? He'll come up. He's going to attack me again. Yeah, so you can find me across all social media at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word. You can find my books, Among Thieves, Thickest Thieves, yay. Gotta Hawk My Wings.
Thick Ass Thieves, coming soon.
Thick Ass Thieves, as the lovely agent would say. And you can find SFF Addicts at SFF Addicts Pod on Instagram, Twitter, all of that good stuff. So yeah, thank you guys all for hanging out with me today. Thanks, and thank everybody that's been watching out there for hanging out with us and get some villainy in your lives.